Welcome to our Friday Five Live podcast hosted by Meg Foster. Meg has spent 20 years in higher education focused on student success initiatives and working in areas such as orientation, faculty development, online learning, student leadership, and first-year initiatives.
Well, happy Friday, everyone. This is such a topic that I was telling Emily this morning, I think comes up every week when we're like, what would it be helpful that we provide information and resources around? And every time we ask that, mental health is top of the list. And amazing, given all that is happening in our crazy world of higher education. Just last week, we did a podcast on leadership in uncertain times. So encourage folks to hop on your favorite podcasting station and listen to that. And on July 25th, we're going to revisit with Melissa Carlton, our fearless judicial expert. What are the legal challenges that we're facing right now in higher education? So I encourage folks to join us for that. But today we're really very fortunate to have Emily and Rick with us to talk about mental health care, to talk about some, and I love Emily really provided this title, this low-key ways that we can care for students and campus communities. And I want to emphasize that because I think often in our conversations, we're very, very appropriately so focused on our students and their mental health needs, because, you know, since the pandemic, that's really been top of mind for college administrators across the United States. But I don't want to lose the emphasis on the campus community piece, because if our staff and our faculty aren't themselves taking care of their mental health, then it is very hard. You know, it's that whole adage of the oxygen mask, right? To then help others. So Emily, I really appreciate that focus that you've given us today. Just a couple of housekeeping tips and tricks real quickly. As a reminder, this does get bundled up as a podcast. So we encourage you to share it with others. I like to think we pair nicely with a good walk for your mental health or a cup of tea or coffee. And so hope you will share this recording after we wrap up today. Also, we love the chat. And Emily and Rick, don't you worry about the chat. But if folks have questions, things they want to weave into the conversation, please put it in the chat. And we will make sure that gets addressed as best we can for today. We have also put a couple of links in as well, and we'll make sure everybody has the link to Emily's website as well as today's questions and PowerPoint presentation. That's all right. We've got lots of folks in our world. So just to kick us off, wanted to start with the big kind of picture. I always try to start there. You know, the last 5 years, I feel like we've talked about mental health a lot on our campuses. What are changes that we're seeing kind of in the evolution of that conversation? And what's different now that we really feel like our campus leaders in particular really need to make sure that they're paying attention to?
Sure. So to start with, 5 years ago, I was actively working on my dissertation research on mental health on college campuses. And I got to that place from being a mental health first aid instructor on campus for 8 years, going through my own struggles, trying to support students with mental health, losing a student to suicide, things like that. And I felt like we're kind of out there, you know, in space, like, what can we do? What's appropriate? What are these things? And so I set about to focus on training graduate students in student affairs and higher education programs and what would be recommended for them as they're coming into the field. I noticed that doing mental health training, people wanted to be supportive and they wanted to be trained and they wanted to know what was appropriate. And we're super grateful to have kind of language around that. And I also noticed counseling centers wanting help and reaching out to me to partner on my campuses around training athletes and various populations because they know that they needed to reach outside of their centers. There wasn't a lot of research at the time and it seemed like it wasn't a priority. This research happened right in the middle of COVID, which was interesting. And so I think now, even if you take COVID out of it, that it was a counseling center concern. So we're hiring consultants to help us, you know, ramp up our counseling centers, but it has to extend beyond that. I also wanted to highlight that there's a real focus on talk therapy. that now that I work in the social work industry and I do behavioral health with kids, I focus a lot. Majority of my work is outside of talk therapy. Talk therapy is great when you're ready to talk and you're in a place to talk and you're able to reach out for that type of support. But there's so many things that you can be doing to help that impact your overall wellness and your emotional well-being that are really powerful. So I feel like that was kind of where we were at. I do feel that faculty and staff were encouraged to not talk about it because of liability, and that there was high stigma. And hopefully that's coming down and people are starting, this next generation is talking about mental health, but that students were suffering in silence. And so I'm glad to see where we're coming to now, that there's new campus programs being built, that people are focused on trauma-informed care. And I wanted to point out some statistics of why leaders can't ignore mental health, which I don't think they're doing. I think there's just a lot going on. But we know that students are entering campus with heightened stress and trauma, but this is coupled with a lack of awareness of what's really going on inside them and skills to handle that. And so to point out a couple of statistics, the American Foundation, I'm so sorry, for suicide prevention in 2023 shared that 9% of high school youth attempted suicide at least once in the last year. So this is post-pandemic. And then also a 2023 study from the National Council for Mental Wellbeing noted that 20% of all high school students seriously considered suicide. So this is the thought process that youth are having. It's an option if things are hard, and we want to really help them focus on emerging issues. How can we help you learn the skills to be able to handle hard days, learn to have emotional regulation in a proactive way that is outside of campus crisis planning, because that's also important. And let's face it, the world is a stressful place right now. Students need to feel safe to learn. And I'm thankful that everyone is here today to be a part of that discussion.
You bring up such good points. I mean, those data points are just incredibly sobering. And I've mentioned this before, I have a kid who's going to college in August, but I also have a sixth grader, and it's interesting to see the difference in social emotional learning that's happened in our school system in those 6 years, right? Like what our youngest child's exposure to discussion and training around how do I identify my emotions? How do I name those things? Suicide prevention training. All of our public school students now go through that in high school. So I find that it'll be interesting to see, have y'all back in 3 or 4 years, right? When we get this kind of next wave of students who I feel like may have had some more of that intentional exposure in the public school and in their school settings, K-12, and see what does the conversation look like then? Because I love, Emily, that while those are sobering numbers, you're also pairing that with seeing less stigma around, mental health concerns, both with our students, right, and with our faculty staff. I certainly feel, and Rick, I'd be curious what your thoughts about this are. I certainly feel that like 10 years ago, it was terrifying as a faculty member. If a student, they were terrified when students said, and not all of them, but certainly a lot of them just didn't feel like they had language skills support if a student identified as somebody who was struggling with their mental health.
I think that's actually where Student Affairs comes in, is I think such wonderful ways on a college campus. And a little bit of history, I've been at Stony Brook for 23 years and in my current role for 8. So I feel like I've spent most of my career in one institution, and particularly around mental health, have seen this incredible evolution. And for folks who are in roles on this call who have to manage a budget, I think one of the things that we started addressing, and this was probably about 10 years ago, was when schools started talking in meetings and saying, oh my gosh, my counseling center is overloaded. That was kind of the first response. And to Emily's point, I think stigma dropped. So that provided, in essence, greater access to those services. And areas were overloaded, but the question of how do we then manage this, which I think then, COVID happened in a 5-year period, and where we are, I think today, and I hope Stony Brook is a leader in this space. I think we are, as well as talking to other colleges around creating a more holistic experience. And so it's not just, again, I think back to my days in college where if you went to the counseling center, it was on that far part of campus and you would go quietly where no one would know you're there. So, and I just think today I'm so relieved that it is integrated at the point of orientation. Our welcome week, we do Wellness Wednesday the very first week you're here. So it just demonstrates and shows to every entering student, this is just part of our culture now. This health and wellness culture is what we all ascribe to. It's an important part. We all face challenges. Again, degrees are different. I also think higher ed's become more accessible to students who have greater needs in the mental health space as well, which again presents a different set of challenges, maybe for our talking our conversation later. But overall, I think the volume and resource demands have really forced us to think differently about how we provide services to students. One thing I'll just share, and I can share more later, I know a lot of schools may look at kind of more of a step kind of program about how you align your services to needs. One thing that we started about 5 years ago, just around the time of COVID, was we created a subunit, actually it's now on its own, called the Student Support Team. Because one thing that I've just noticed in my own, career and time at Stony Brook is that not everybody needs one-on-one therapy for even a short or long-term period. A lot of the issues students face, they're problems. They need someone who's going to help in terms of being a problem solver. And I would argue more of that coaching style to help you work through whatever the issue is. So the Student Support Team has served in that capacity. We actually now have a large team that really is that first line of if you need help, that's where you go. And Meg, to your point about the campus and faculty and other staff, I think having this fear of saying, if a student comes to me with a mental health concern, I'm not equipped to be able to respond. And so I would say we view at Stony Brook, and I think a lot of student different areas, we view faculty and staff, they are incredible and necessary partners in this work. But we also don't expect faculty and staff who are not trained to serve in roles in which, again, they're not either equipped or comfortable. One tool that we created, and we're happy to share the resource several years ago, we created an online tool called the Red Book. Our color is red, so we call it the Red Book. And we identify in that Red Book a series of different, whether it's suicidal concerns, a disruption in class, a student who's disappeared from class, whatever the situation is, we have given quick tips on what you can and should say to a student and how to make the handoff and referral to the appropriate resource for help. And so that has alleviated, I think, a lot of concern. So we sent out a message twice a year to the whole campus to let them know about the resource. And again, we've put for our, we have our care team, our behavioral intervention team, our student support team, our CAPS, our counseling team. We have quite the infrastructure in place to be able to manage it. And I would say it's this well-oiled machine that works well, but we're not going to put undue pressure on somebody that just they're either don't have the time to do it or they're just not equipped to manage it. So the referral process is something we actively communicate to get students the care they need at the right place and right time.
Wow. Emily, I know that's why you wanted to make sure Rick came and talked. That is just incredible. I mean, and I think about at our institutions and you know, I teach at a community college. I mean, the reality in our higher ed institutions is most students are being taught by part-time people, right? And so if you have these resources that are available that help give language to, or here's some scenarios you might encounter, don't panic. Here's some direction about what to do at our institution and how to get students in touch. I mean, I really love that approach. It seems very centering of this whole notion of wellness on our institutions.
Yeah. And not just focusing on a counseling center as the solution. It has to be broader. And putting boundaries on, what are the appropriate ways that faculty and staff can be a caring human and helping them know, they don't want to be responsible for suicide ideation and things like that, but it's okay to talk to a student and listen, really listen to them and then help figure out, okay, now where do I go with this? It's not on me to fix.
Can I add to that? One thing, and looking at our numbers within our counseling center, we've seen certainly the severity of some situations are it's really challenging. So there's a range of mental health needs and concerns on a campus. Well, one thing I will say, Meg, and to some of the point about the campus community's engagement, we rely also on a true partnership and team approach, particularly in our care team that addresses really higher acuity situations. And that includes our university police. We do partner particularly with the academic sector about academic accommodations, our disability support area. So all of the lenses that come into that room evaluating a case that comes in that we need to figure out, like, what's the best way to address it? It really works so effectively when you have people with a different area of expertise because you do need your academic partner there because whether it's a late withdrawal, whether it's an incomplete, there's something or there's engagement by the faculty, give them language. How do they address that in the classroom? What are the steps they can take? That's all part of the process, I think, that makes a system work effectively if you are partnering. And I'm going to just make one point on the university police front, whether it's public safety or university police. I will say that partnership's also essential. I think on the one hand, social media has created so many challenges in our society, which I think has led to many mental health concerns. Yet it has also been a tool that we've utilized, pinging a cell phone, being able to identify students. So if there is a suicide attempt, by partnering with our police and doing a lot of proactive work in that space, they've saved many, many lives over the years. That I think behind the scenes, the average person would have no idea. But it's that collective communication and not holding information, which really kind of harkens back even to Virginia Tech, when individuals the point of that conversation, the dots were not connected. And I think that's a critical part of the partnerships that the skills that people have around helping to make sure that you're connecting people to really save a life when you're at a more severe state, because response time in a lot of it is critical to saving a life if you're getting to that extreme situation.
And I really hear this theme, and I feel like this has been the theme for the year on our podcast, Rick, has been this idea of cl as clear communication as possible and bringing in and not feeling like we have to operate in a silo, right? Like those days are done. Like I declare higher ed done with silos. That's not it just don't it doesn't work. And it's not in the best interest of our communities. And so being able to bring together these teams where, you know, we all have this kind of common goal and purpose, but we're all allowed to bring our expertise. I mean, that's what we are in higher ed, right? I mean, subject matter experts come bring that skill and help our community. Rick, you want to say share something?
I'm good.
Emily, so let's turn maybe the lens for a second then, because we are worried about our students. I mean, and you pointing out social media being the blessing and the curse that that it is. Faculty and staff, you know, I think, bless them, sometimes they feel a little neglected in these spaces, right? That we're just so focused on students that we kind of forget. And you know, we're seeing attrition and we're seeing people get burned out and I know this was the, I'm going to admit how dumb and naive I was. I really thought we'd have a recovery from the pandemic in our professional environment, that there would be like a lift and we would all, oh yes, I feel refreshed and renewed. And I'm still waiting for that. And it's been 5 years or however many years, 6 years it's been, 5 years it's been now. So what about our faculty and staff? What are ways, things you're seeing that are helping to really create community that it's we're lifting and supporting the mental health of everyone here, not just one segment of that population?
Yeah, I think first of all, when you look at what Rick is sharing about embedding these things across campus, hopefully all of these things become embedded in a way that is everywhere. And faculty and staff need to role model that they have hard days too, and that they get through them. They can't be everything's okay all the time. And maybe, with appropriate disclosure, I'm not saying not to have that. But traditionally, campuses were not a place to talk about mental health, let alone for faculty and staff. And I've certainly been in environments where you're not allowed to say if you don't know something, if you're not getting it, if you're not feeling good. And I think some of it you've seen in recent CEO debates is up to the staff member themselves to be empowered to have boundaries, those sorts of things. But I was in student affairs for 20 years, and on duty nights, weekends, working multiple programs, 60 to 80 hours a week is not sustainable for staff. And I know I did that, and I did that as a director so that my staff wouldn't have to work those hours. And guess what? I got sick. And that wasn't sustainable for me. So I think focusing on changing deficit thinking, because there are a lot of people in my business too. I have staff that I want to know if they need new training because they're out there with families and kids. If they're not understanding something, if there's a risky situation, I want them to not feel any negativity around calling for help. And there's a lot of deficit thinking. So, and this applies to students thinking about mental health as well. It's something is wrong with you versus how do we build the skills to handle this? And so how do we take the deficit thinking that sometimes happen in higher ed and kind of shift that to what can we do here? What's behind this? What is the need and how can we address that? And if we can get to a space where staff can honestly say, yeah, I'm struggling with that, instead of suck it up and keep working, and we're getting more students than ever. I've always been on campuses that were growing and we didn't have enough space, et cetera. Really being able to allow them to say what's happening, but move forward with solutions. I think life happens to all of us, so let's normalize that and let's focus on actions we can take. I do really believe in putting the oxygen mask on first. Faculty and staff aren't going to be able to be there and care and listen to the stories that are going on in a profound way if they are themselves hurting or, not in a place to understand their own mental well-being. And so I see this as a great opportunity to practice everyday wellness and to model it to students and to say, hey, we've all gone through things. And here's how I was resilient. Here's how, I found my way through that. And starting to talk about those little building blocks that help those protective factors and the strengths that people have.
I'm thinking about the class that I taught this semester, and I teach first year experience classes, and I've never had a class like that. Like, the needs were so great with the students in this class, and every student, a wonderful group, but just demanded a level of care that I had not experienced in 20 years of teaching. And I'm how could I, guiding them through these conversations, being available to them with some boundaries, right? You can text me, but I'm not answering you at 2 o'clock in the morning because I'm not going to be awake then. And that's, so I've Emily, I'm really here this like opening myself up to sharing. Life happens, there are struggles, let's model that behavior, and then providing those wellness resources, connecting them to the ones on campus. And I'm very fortunate to work at an institution with a lot of really caring people who are setting up great resources for students, and who are very supportive of me when I was like, whoa, I thought I knew what I was doing, but I don't know what I'm doing this semester. So modeling that, and helping, I love that idea of building these building blocks, right? And we need to sometimes in our communities, and Rick, I don't know if y'all are doing this at Stony Brook. I know we do a lot of our community building blocks, like the ones that Emily's part of, like, right? It's not just what our institution is doing, it's putting it into the context of the community that we operate in as well.
I mean, as you're talking, there's so many layers to this, and a couple I wanted to just add if I could. One is that, and it does, I think, begin also with an institutional commitment. So, like you had shared, if you bring it to this individual student level and the level of need they spoke in your class about, and you're thinking, oh my, it can't all fall on one person for one thing. So, I always think about from an institutional commitment level, and I know I've been really fortunate. I've talked to other colleagues who are also fortunate in that. When you're in an environment where limited resources, we have finite resources, how do you get the investment you need in the mental health space to support students? And I think the advocacy for that kind of work, I mean, does come at every level of the organization, but it's really, I think, at the top to say, this is a priority. We need to invest in this resource. We were fortunate enough to give an example, and this is kind of this wraparound strategy that needs to be employed. It is a 24/7 environment. And the fact that, this notion that accounts in their any office closes at 5, but then if there's an issue, it either falls to the hall director or there's no one else around. We invested, and there are a lot of providers out there, but we use Timely Care for we and it has been incredible. It's been our third year in a partnership with them. Incredibly high quality ratings from students who use it. But what's fascinating more than anything is 50% of the use is after hours and on weekends. So just speaking to who the college student is nowadays, we don't operate in the normal 9 to 5 Monday to Friday realm as a college student, especially if you have a highly residential campus. So I think that's one consideration. But the other thing that just struck me when I keep thinking about the students, say, Meg, in your class who have those needs, we think that like who are the people to kind of be who are the helpers? And ultimately, especially if you're in student affairs, you're in it because you're in a helping profession, because you care. But one thing, I've shared this within my own team, we have in student affairs, one of our strategic priorities, because we have five priorities, four of them are all about the student, but the fifth one is about us. And we call it organizational health and excellence. So we want the team to know that we value, and that priority is the oxygen mask piece, as you both have discussed. That's really what it's about us. How do we make sure you're healthy and well so you can be your best at serving students? And there are a variety of strategies. It might be for us, we do allow some remote work because that's a morale builder. So we want that. But we agree, like since COVID, and I read so many things where higher ed professionals feel just it's an overwhelming experience to still work in the field and how do you manage everything. But I will say one thing, because I've been there in my own career. I think, and I said this to my own team, we have to also be the ones to set some boundaries. And I've seen many professionals who give everything to their job because, again, let's face it, it could be 24/7 if you allow it. And I always share, look, it's reasonable to have high expectations of our performance in our job, but if you're ever given a vacation day, that's a problem. If you're ever going beyond a point where you just know you're harming your own health and wellness, you've got to set those boundaries and limits for yourself because no one else will do that for you. You have to do that. So whether it's us giving permission or encouragement, I'm not sure what the right word is, but and I don't want to use the word martyr, but sometimes we get into martyr syndrome, like I'm the savior, only I can do this. And then people then that leads to burnout. And so I think it's a two-way street of the team member working through what their own needs are, and then the leadership team also role modeling that kind of behavior and encouraging so that they know the expectations are not unreasonable.
Yep, I totally agree with everything you just said.
I
And
want
I do think there are places where you're not allowed to do that, but I'm hoping that that's changing, right? That we're looking at management styles and yeah, this like suck it up mentality is making you internalize and just step away and then leave the field versus if we could really be honest and have a chat and be okay and not judge each other, you know?
I think one of the hardest spots, and I started my career, I was a residence hall director many years ago. So I always think about those jobs fondly because I know what kind of pressure that is, because especially if you live in or live on, you really, and that's often the group where I'm talking, how do you create separation? How do you end your workday and create a balanced life for yourself? Because that it's much easier if you are driving off campus at the end of the day. But that's been an area where, again, it's looking at resources. How do you invest so that you don't have someone who's on duty 3 weekends a month? I mean, you've got to work through it so that it's more about, and I've even asked our own team, we're a large system, so a larger system gives you a little bit more flexibility in the model. But that's a very important part where I want our team to feel like they have freedom, flexibility. They still work hard, but they're not saturated in the environment where they just feel overwhelmed and don't have a life outside of work. And I think we've struck that balance. You'd have to ask them, but I really think, because I ask that a lot, is the duty routine, is it fair? Is it reasonable? Like, we want to hear honestly what people think is a good model to use.
So I'm curious. I mean, I really, really love, Rick, that you have centered wellness for the staff, like your team, as part of your goals. I mean, that's incredible. Outside of modeling, because I know you're off to concert tonight, right? So outside of modeling that behavior, for your team, what are other things you're doing?
Yeah, I'll give you actually this is the timing couldn't be better. So last Thursday we started, let's say this was actually a suggestion of the team. We always ask for ideas. This came out at a we do an annual award ceremony and we have a piece of paper, say you have ideas, write them down. And one idea is why don't we do a divisional retreat? So we do an annual retreat. Now it's our second one. We've done it. We have a campus on the east end of Long Island. People love going. We're a team of 300 and we have focused it. It's centered around health and wellness for the day. That's what it is. So togetherness and just community building, all of that works well. One other thing I want you, and this is not work that I've done, but I've been really impressed at the institutional level. We have, and this is an arm of our human resources division at Stony Brook. And it's led by a woman named Catherine Duffy, and it's called Healthier You. And she and the team do a fantastic job. So their focus is really on workplace culture around health and wellness. So for example, I ran it a couple weeks ago, but they did a 5K run on campus one day. One thing they just started doing, which I absolutely love, I'm trying to think like what are the low-hanging fruit and easy things to do? They send out to campus about now, I think it's going to be on a monthly basis, but they send out, a 1 minute, 1 or 2 minute video of just really you know the nature scene you see on CBS Sunday morning at the end of the show. It's that peaceful and calm visual. They send it out and they said, please sit at your office and close your eyes and listen for the 90-second video. And I've done it because it's you can find 2 minutes in your day to do it. And it's quick and easy. And whoever came up with the idea, it's just so creative. Again, simple way to send a powerful message to your team around take a pause and that we care about your wellness. So to me, a lot of it's around messaging of support of saying we care about you and your wellness matters to us.
Thank you for sharing all that, Rick. I mean, you're gonna have everybody, we're all gonna come work.
Well, that's half of my idea. Come work with us. We love
Like we will post open job opportunities in the chat room. So you're talking through, I mean, I feel like you've really addressed a lot of these questions. And I know that we are just in the weirdest place in higher ed, I feel like. And I think I can say that, we all three of us on this call have a couple decades now in this wonderful professional environment. And I think we know our history through our academic training. But anything, I feel like just this place of scrutiny that we're in, and this place of constant questioning, and we're really having, I don't know if anybody else feels this way. I just feel like the whole semester has been reaction to decisions I have no control over, right? And Emily, I know you're dealing with this. I mean, in your work, very, very much at the, inches away from your face kind of space. But anything you're seeing that you're like, here are some ways we can respond or think about or place into context these things that we have no control over. Because there are moments, just to be very frank, that I'm pretty angry. I'm having to spend my precious work time responding to something that it feels ridiculous, that I can't get the work done that needs to get done, right? Because I'm in response mode, which is not my favorite place to be.
Yeah, so two things for that, totally separate things. One is that is a time where it's even more important for you to be practicing your own wellness and understanding your nervous system and when you're dysregulated. For me, I deal with really hard cases. I was in court this week for DCS removal, and it's just I know these families and I care about them. For me, I have to go to restorative yoga on Fridays. And to me, that resets my nervous system. And I can actually rest during the weekend, and I can actually put these hard stories aside and live my life. And people need to practice what that is for them. And keep trying, because there's so many kids who'll be like, "Don't tell me to breathe," right? It has to be beyond that. Like I have to keep trying. And for some kids, it's sports, and for some kids, it's music, and it's not. There's so many ways to regulate your nervous system. And it's practicing and seeing what works for you. Some people are like, don't take me to nature, but some kids, hey, let's go on a hike around the lake. And now I feel better. It's knowing that for yourself. so that you can center. For me, I do tapping. I do a lot of woo-woo things that used to be considered really woo-woo. I meditate every day, and it really helps me take that time for myself to just be silent. I have 20 minutes every morning where I am silent with myself, and I'm trying to turn my thoughts off and just be. And that really helps. So that's one answer. The other answer is, so I did a lot of work for an LGBT volunteer crisis suicide line, and I know the stress that they're calling in with, and I know how being targeted is impacting people, and it's increasing risk, and it's increasing crisis and acuity. My take on it, and Rick can talk to the actual federal regulations, is there's a way to stay above detail. Your programs, it's known, written down, that kind of thing, where you know your high-risk populations, you know them, and you might not be able to specifically talk about them right now or write them in your descriptions, that kind of thing. I think of a letter I just got from Purdue saying we're sunsetting all of our diversity programs, and it's such an internal battle of values for people. But that's what they thought was best. And their messaging was, we still serve everyone and we still care about everyone. How can we send that message of community while people are being targeted, institutions are being targeted, identities are being targeted? It's even more important to build that sense of community, but perhaps keeping it on a general level, but not losing sight of the fact that if you have a trans student on campus, that they're 12 times more likely to die by suicide. Things like that. And it's still okay to have those discussions, I believe, at this time. But you know, maybe perhaps you keep it up here at this level, but you know what those things are.
Thank you.
And it's difficult too, because, and I think this has been happening over the last decade or so, and some of it related to, I think, the rising cost of higher education, which has also been because we need to invest in more in mental health support. I mean, it's all related to what the expectations of higher ed are for our students, but also there's a price tag associated with that kind of level of service. But the public confidence, we all know, Meg, I think some of your point is that it's eroded over time. And so, and on the one hand, that's difficult to hear because you feel that in your daily work, especially when you're working directly with students, there's so much, I mean, the level of fulfillment and satisfaction in helping a student pass a test, you know, figure out, like, help build their identity, su support them in finding an internship, and then they ultimately graduate and they find a job, and they're a first gen student, and the parents are cheering at graduation. I mean, all those moments in time, these snapshots, are exactly why we do the work that we do. But I think it's really hard. I think what I and maybe this is not the right approach, but I want to be honest with our team, and we do have conversations about this because we can't ignore what's external to us. But I also think I try to shield people and say, look, just focus on the work that we're doing. We're doing great work. Keep your head in the game, and that's what we're going to do. Because all the noise around us, I mean, honestly, it could make you not sleep at night at all. And even questioning the value of, why do I do the work that I do every day? So I think that has ramped up, as we all know, especially in the last several months. And to Emily's point too, just, I mean, identities. Particularly around our immigrant undocumented students. And this even adds, I think, to the mental health challenge, is that now it's, I think, there's a culture of fear. There's so much fear out there that I know on our campus, we're such a diverse campus, speak to students a lot about that. And you try to be the protector of everybody. Like, can we build a moat around our campus and then no one gets in other than the people that, you know, because we feel we're really good. We're a strong community. We know what we're doing. We don't need the outside agitators involved. But it's very hard when you're in an environment where, you know, there's a threat to either Pell being cut, or you not being able to, right now with visas, or a change in an attitude that we don't value a campus being a global institution, which, you know, again, I think many of us who worked in the field, that is the point. Being a global, it is a wonderful thing. I mean, the exchange of ideas, we are one world, our thing. So right, we are having an incredible clash of values, and trying to come to terms with that. And as we know, court cases left and right. And in my 32 years in higher ed, I've never seen this degree of chaos. But I just try to, again, still stay focused on our campus, what are our needs for our students, try to just push the rest aside, because again, I think it could really derail you if you if you re honestly, if you read too much, if you overthink it too much, you just have to keep moving, doing what you feel your calling is.
I love that advice that you're in a space as a leader. I mean, you don't the vice president title is not one you wear lightly. And to say that you're sort of saying, I got the big picture here, and I'm gonna share information because I think communication is really key. We talk a lot about that. And last week when we were talking about leadership in uncertain times, Naomi Sigg, who's a vice president for student affairs at John Carroll University, she was like, it's important that I am open and I'm communicating with my team so they know, I'm aware of the fact that we have a large international student population and I'm aware of what's going on federally, right, with regards to that. But I'll worry about that part. And I just need you to focus on the great work you're doing with supporting those international students. I mean, I think what a kind and caring, healthy message, right, to share to our teams. And I love that leadership that you're that way that you're modeling that for your 299 other employees in the
Thank you.
Division of Student Affairs. Well, we just have a few minutes. This always goes by way too fast, in my personal opinion. I mean, I know we got to go listen to live music today, but and Emily brought Rick on from Stony Brook because I asked, give us a campus success story. Who's someone doing it right? And she was like, I know exactly who I need here. And so, Rick, I just really want to say thank you very much for your willingness to jump in here tonight today, and Emily for highlighting, because that's one thing I don't always think we do a good job of in our world of student affairs. I think we're really great at beating ourselves up. And this goes back to that mental health message, but we're not great at celebrating our wins sometimes. And even those don't have to be like the aha big thing, right? It can be the first gen student who walks across the stage and you're crying just as hard as their mom is, because of that graduation. So I would encourage us all, like, as we continue the summer, thinking about what are those wins, wherever you are in your space, being able to take a moment to celebrate those, I think is really, really important. But just any final thoughts, if you could lead us out of this discussion with like one final thought around our mental health on our campuses for all of our community, what would that be?
Yeah, so I think it boils down to really for me being able to step out and be in the social work field. How are we tying those perspectives into student development theory? And learning these little things like what is the need behind this behavior instead of seeing bad behavior? Are we helping with secure attachment or attachment wounds for people? And how are we addressing the nervous system? Are we even aware? When I was in college, I certainly wasn't aware when I was dysregulated. I just knew I was upset, right, about something. And really taking those times to focus on skill building. It doesn't have to be a big mental health thing. It can be everyday practice that I do for myself. What are you doing for yourself? When I'm heightened, here's what I do. And this is what we work on every day with families and children of multiple ages. It could look really different. It could look like fight or flight. It could look like withdrawing and not talking to anyone. It can look like a panic attack. It's all the same. And overall wellness, all the steps of wellness impact your mental health.
Emily, that's
And
really
I think if I could just add, so Emily, I think spoke more on the individual level. I'll just make sure my comments more on the organizational level. And I think for me, it comes down to how do you build on a college campus a culture of care? I mean, that really is so that, and I've used examples where if everyone's all in and you have the same view, whether you can use the word DEI or not, whatever, it goes down to the core of an institution. If you had to describe your institution, what words would you use? Can you legitimately say we are a place of like we are a caring community? Because a lot it's around role modeling, it's around programming, it's around your communication strategies. Like how do you embed all of that to then build, like you have to build the culture you want by promoting it right from the get, even from when you start getting prospective students. How do you build that culture so that everyone feels that everyone has each other's backs? I mean, that's a big part of, I think, trying to build so that mental health and other elements it's a shared responsibility too. It doesn't just fall on the vice president or the president. We all are responsible for the success of every member of our community. But I think it's like a feeling you walk on and you go, do I feel like I belong? Like someone cares about me, like I have friends here, there's a support network. Again, it takes a lot of work. It doesn't happen just organically. There's a lot of structure that needs to be put in place for that to happen. But I think, gee, that's how I know if I see that, that's where the individual and the organization collectively come together and you know it works.
Rick, that is a great way, I think, to end us. Like thinking about how are we both operating individually, as Emily shared, but then how do we build these cultures of care? And we've had some podcast discussions about that over the years with different institutions and what they're doing. But ultimately, whether you're a faculty member, a staff member, or a student, when you walk on campus, do you feel cared for? You know, do you feel like you belong? Do you have a place there? And how do we all contribute to that kind of community at our institutions? Thank you both so much for just, I feel like, a really fantastic Friday discussion, and folks are chatting in that they really appreciate all that you shared with us today. I hope everybody has an opportunity this weekend. I know Rick and Emily are going off to see live music tonight, that there's opportunities for rest and renewal in your weekend so that we can continue to do the good work that we are doing. We've put in the links, just as a reminder, Emily's website there, but would also encourage you join us on July 25th. We're going to be talking about legal issues in higher education. We might need to do some mental health check-in before and after that discussion, because that promises to be an intense one. But thank you both so much for your time and sharing your wisdom and expertise with you. Emily, it's always great to see you. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you so much. I loved it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Good.
Thank
Well,
you.
you're
Thank
now
you, Rick.
part of the community. Congratulations. You're part of the family. So,
Thanks.
yeah, we appreciate it. Take care, everyone. Have a great week.
Friday Five Live is brought to you by Innovative Educators. Innovative Educators offers 6 online services for your onboarding support and training needs. Visit us at innovativeeducators.org to see how we can support your student success initiatives.